Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
You're listening to the Gravity Podcast. I'm Matt Tebbe, one of your co-hosts, joined by the other co-hosts, Christy Penley and Ben Sternke. You're both looking well.
You sound very radio-esque.
Yeah, well, no, I think he sounds robot-esque. I think Matt's been replaced by a robot.
I can do all things.
Podcast robot.
It's through an Christ AI who strengthens robot. Me, including let your insults roll off my back. So I wanted to tell you guys about this show I found on Netflix.
Okay.
My son and I started watching a show called Resident Alien. Have you heard of this show, Resident Alien?
Yeah. I watched a few episodes of this.
Okay. So it's like PG-13. You know, a couple of the characters could use some soap in the mouth. So the show's about an alien that's coming to Earth to wipe out humanity, to kill everybody. But he crashes, and then he gets into a fight with a human, and the human dies, and he takes on the appearance of the human. And now he has to learn how to be human while he finds his crashed ship and repairs it. And everybody sees him as this guy that dies, except like one in a million can see through his disguise, and it's a 10-year-old boy.
Oh.
And so it's part sci-fi, part comedy, part like heartwarming drama.
Oh.
And it's, I don't know, I've never seen a show like it. Okay. I laugh out loud 3 or 4 times a show.
Does Deegan like it?
Yes.
Okay.
So he's 15 and he's really hard. It's hard for him to like get into something. It's hard for us to get into something together, but it's really great. It's like, do you remember that? Remember the show Perfect Strangers?
Yeah.
With Balki Bartakamus. Yep. Yeah. Remember that was when we were kids? Mm-hmm. It's got kind of that campy feel to it. Like that show was like somebody from outside of America, like an Eastern European country coming to America and learning what America was like and making all kinds of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And the alien is doing the same thing with being a human. And so there's like that comedy of somebody learning what it means to be a human. But also one of the things that happens, and there's the third season just came out and we just started the second season, but this alien is, while this alien spends time in this human body, is becoming more and more human. Mm-hmm. And the alien hates it. So it's like sweet too. Like there's a sweetness to it. Anyway, yeah. I recommend it. It's PG-13, everybody, but I recommend it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. What you got for us, Ben?
I
want to tell us about your plumber.
I would highly recommend the plumber that's working on our bathroom right now. They are just right next door, working on restoring an old, cast iron tub. Anyway, we'll see. Actually, they're installing it now. So we'll see maybe next week I'll tell you if I recommend them or not. I would say one of the links for the week, every week, listener, if you're not on our email list, here's your little, advertisement to get on our email list. You can do that on our website, gravitycommons.com. But, one of the articles, I think, Matt, that you had found by Karen Keene, on digital minimalism, how to practice digital minimalism, I found really, really helpful.
Yeah.
And we linked to that article in the curated links, and I'll put it in the show notes for this podcast episode. But I found her approach, really helpful in at least a couple ways. One, I think sometimes, I don't know, people think of like digital minimalism, like I'm going to fast from social media on my phone during Lent or, you know, things like that. They think of it as like this all or nothing, like I'm going to throw my phone into the river and you know, like nothing. They think of it in an all or nothing kind of way, but I appreciated her very measured clarity around, wait, like what is it that I'm doing when I look for my, you know, reach for my phone? And what's the intention behind some of the disciplines that I'm embracing as it regards trying to be a digital minimalist, which is she takes that from a book of the same title called Digital Minimalism by a guy named Cal Newport that I've also appreciated his stuff. So anyway, I appreciated that article. That would be my recommendation for the week. And we'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Well, my recommendation is what a friend of mine said to me like 10 years ago. I worked with this guy. His name's Scott Boss. He's awesome. And he would say often, we need to eat more cake. And what he meant by that was that you need to celebrate more. You got to celebrate more. And so my husband just changed jobs. Today's his first day on this new job. He's been in another place for 15 years. And so yesterday, I made a big steak and salmon and this whole big meal because I was like, we got to celebrate. 15 years is a big deal. And then I was like, wait, we need to celebrate lots of things, not just when you've been in a place for 15 years and you get a new job. And so my daughter came home and she had a Spanish quiz and she's like, Mom, I got 10 out of 10. And I did a mom crazy dance celebrating her. And then I was like, oh, we just need to eat more cake. So listener, maybe just find something to celebrate today and celebrate it. That's my suggestion. Wow.
That's amazing.
That's great.
I'm going to celebrate. I'm going to celebrate me.
Okay. Woohoo. Yeah. We love Matt Tevi.
Go, Matt.
No one else has to celebrate me, but I'm going to do it.
Okay. All right.
I'll
just say, I think like you said, we should eat more cake is sort of a metaphor, but I was going to say if my wife was listening to this podcast episode, she'd be disappointed that it was a metaphor because cake is probably her top
love
food.
Language.
Oh, she just loves cake. And sadly, she needs to eat mostly gluten-free. And so it's kind of this tortured relationship that she has with cake because it's just her favorite thing to eat. She just loves cake, but she can't have it. So anyway.
True.
Sorry, yeah. Deb.
She also loves the Eucharist, and she does have that.
She does, yeah. So she eats mostly gluten-free, but gluten-full Eucharist bread she can handle. So it's just a little bite.
All right. Well, on that anticlimactic note of your wife, not being able to celebrate the thing that she wants to celebrate.
I know.
Listener, you will appreciate and even maybe celebrate this interview we have with Pete Enns, who has, getting feedback from a number of our listeners, you're probably familiar with Pete and his work with Jared on the Bible for Normal People. We chatted with him about two of his latest books, including his latest Curveball. And, Pete, I just so appreciate how Pete's normal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I think I learn a lot about the Bible from him. But also, I think I would just want to go water skiing with him too, Mm-hmm. He just seems a fun guy to be around.
Yeah. This is a great interview.
This interview is kind of a crossover interview. It's like we've done a series on deconstruction. We've done a series on the Bible, and Pete sort of does both of those things in one episode. So we celebrate being able to bring this podcast to you.
Yeah. It's already gotten rave reviews.
All right.
From our paid subscriber community on the Gravity community, people can access podcast episodes early.
Yeah.
And a couple people have watched this one already and listened to it. And they said it was incredible and amazing. So really excited to bring it to you. Enjoy it. Pete Enns, listener.
Pete Enns joins us today on the Gravity Podcast. He's the Abram S. Clemens Professor of Biblical Studies at Eastern University and the co-host, along with Jared Bias, of the Bible for Normal People podcast. He's the author of The Sin of Certainty, The Bible Tells Me So, Inspiration and Incarnation, along with many other books. And we're talking to him today about his latest two books, mostly, How the Bible Actually Works. We'll be excited to learn that, I'm sure. And Curveball, When Your Faith Takes Turns You Never Saw Coming. Pete, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Pete, I consistently hear, I think Ben and Christy could amen this as well, that from our listeners, that there's two podcasts that have helped them more than any other understand how to read the Bible and what it's about. And it's The Bible for Normal People and The Bible Project, right? Tell us a bit about how you and Jared conceived of your podcast and how you describe the work you're doing.
Well, I mean, the podcast grew out of just The Bible for Normal People, because that was there before the podcast. And it was really trying to have conversations with people who want to have them about just what biblical scholarship adds to our understanding of the Bible. And you know, some things are challenging, some things are less so. But we found a lot of people just, they like seeing it from different angles because they're searching themselves for different ways of thinking about the Bible. So that's how it all started. And then I guess maybe 3 years in, as the story now becoming legendary around our parts goes, Jared called me one day and he said, "Pete, on a scale of 1 to 5, how much would you hate having a podcast?" And I said, "Well, I wouldn't hate it at all. It'd be sort of fun. I just don't want to do anything. I don't want to think about technology. I don't want to think about anything like that. I just want to talk to people." And so we just started doing it. And, you know, like all podcasts, it grew in the sense of like we figured out what we were doing after a year or so. And it's just been a lot of fun. And we learn things from our guests. You know, we have people on who know things about things that we don't know anything about. And it's fun to talk to these people. And you know, we get changed as a result of that too. And I think a lot of people listening seem to like that experience as well, that there's not just one way to think about things. And, you know, a common comment we get is, "I thought I was crazy. I thought I was the only person who thought like that." Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, there's a whole field that thinks that way. So those are been very gratifying things.
Mm. Yeah. And I don't know if our listeners even know, but there is an entire website, The Bible for Normal People, that mm-hmm. has classes and coffee mugs and more. So we'll be able to plug that at the end here.
Right. Yeah.
But so much, Pete, of your writing, starting with Inspiration and Incarnation, which is like 20 years now or so?
Yeah, it's pushing 20 years, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. has been about your relationship to the Bible. So mm-hmm. maybe to frame this conversation we're going to have, what is it about your relationship, about you and the Bible, that has generated so many thoughts? Like what, like at some point, it's a fixed canon, right? So at some point, don't we run out of things to say, or why is it an ever new, ever refreshing flow of thoughts for you?
Because I'm trying to appropriate it. You know, it's not just mm-hmm. out there. It's the intersection between the text and the traditions mm-hmm. around the text and my own existence as a Christian. And once you start, you know, scratching a little bit and finding things, it's you just realize you can scratch widely, or you can focus on one thing and keep scratching down, 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 down. And you realize how deeply people have thought about these things throughout history. And, you know, the more we learn about the context of Scripture, the more things we have to talk about. And it, you know, there is, I do think you run out of things, you know, after a while to talk about. I don't think we're anywhere near that, but we do run out of things to talk about theoretically because it's a finite corpus. But I mean, you could do a multi-year podcast on the book of Isaiah if you want to. Sure. I mean, it's not hard. There's a lot going on there. And I think the thing is also the same questions keep coming up through history. Just talking about Adam and Eve with some people and how, like, that's a story that just keeps on giving because people have the same questions. Where'd Cain get his wife from? You know, what's God doing putting a garden with all these tempting things in it? I mean, all these questions come up, and it's nice to have contemporary voices speaking into those old questions. So in that sense, in those two senses, it's like, yeah, it's finite, but I mean, it will exhaust my lifetime, that's for sure, talking about this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's the horizon of the scriptures, you know, the ancient writings that we have, but then the horizon of our own modern day lives, I mean, mm-hmm. that keeps changing. And so the questions keep changing and our perspective keeps right. changing and right. we keep asking nuanced questions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And part of that too is exploring the history of, you know, Christian and or Jewish interpretation, how right. there's a whole history of doing that very same thing for their quote contemporary moment. It's just not contemporary yeah. for us. Yeah. So, I mean, if you're serious about this kind of stuff, those are the areas you start gravitating to. Like, mm-hmm. you know, what did Thomas Aquinas say about this problem that I thought I was the first one to think about it? You know, it just doesn't work that right. way. And, yeah. and you say, like, I don't understand him very well, or, I mean, I'm not sure if he's helping, but the fact is that he thought about X, Y, and Z. And,
right.
and it's our obligation, I think, really to look into that and have those kinds of conversations. And with our podcast, we bring people on who know stuff like that,
right.
you know, who can help us and move forward.
Hey, Pete, I'm wondering, you know, one way of describing your journey is that you've had to adjust your way of thinking about and talking about God. Mm-hmm. In your book, Curveball, you make the case that this is a very biblical thing to do. In other words, the Bible itself tells the story of God's people misunderstanding and re-understanding. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just double-click on that and just share a bit about that with us.
Yeah, I think for me, Christy, one of the things that really changed everything for me is noticing that very thing that you just picked up on. It's how the Bible itself is again and again and again, sort of a snapshot of not, you know, one time in history, but spanning at least a millennium, you know, I mean, more than that, really, frankly, with Hebrew Bible and New Testament. And we're watching people adapt a tradition to account for their own experiences, you know, which I know many of us have been told, don't trust your experiences. They don't do you any good. You just have to talk to the Bible. I'm like, well, the Bible is doing that itself. People's experiences are affecting how they think about God and how they think about their tradition, how they think about the future. And for me, that was tremendously liberating to do. And I tell you, I wouldn't have seen it apart from the influence of Jewish professors I had in graduate school, where they live this, right? And yeah. and Christians, we tend not to think about the Bible as this internal conversation debate over what God is like and all these kinds of mm-hmm. things. And so, yeah, it changed my thinking, and with great joy, frankly, and with anticipation. It wasn't a burden when I saw that. It was like, oh, okay, there's a lot to think about here. It's, you know, it's not a rule book. It's not a field guide to faith. It's not any of those things. It's in itself an extended conversation that then gets brought into contexts even outside of that period of time that produced this conversational text. And again, this is, I mean, I don't want to talk your ear off about this, but this is part of the Jewish tradition that I learned to value, where that's exactly what they do. Yes, scripture has some fundamental notion, but if you ask, you know, in Jewish tradition, you know, how should we feel about this issue or that issue? Well, that's where the Talmudists come into play, because it's mm-hmm. not just the Bible, it's the tradition after the Bible. Yeah. And Christians have something similar. We have the history of theology. Mm-hmm. And we might phrase it a little bit differently, but we're doing the same thing anyway. And it's a very diverse history. And the Bible, I think, generates that, you know, and mm-hmm. and it's like, okay, thank you. That's I can get up in the morning and do this, you know, and not like hand-wring over, do I have the right answer about everything?
Yeah.
It's, you know, I remember being in high school and someone telling me the Bible was basic instructions before leaving Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And what yeah. I'm hearing you say is, no, it's painting a portrait, an accurate mm-hmm. portrait of who God is. And the paint is almost constantly wet.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we get to paint, you yeah. know, I mean, that's mm-hmm. just it. And, And well, you're not supposed to add to the Word of God. I know that. Actually, you're not supposed to add to the Book of Revelation. That's what it's about. Right. It's not about the whole Bible. But apart from that, I mean, I understand. I mean, respecting the canon, even though we have a different canon than other Christians have, you know, in the Protestant right. world.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and we have a different order than the Hebrew Bible has and all that kind of stuff. So the canons are different. But the idea of canon, I respect that. But the purpose of the canon is to do exactly what you just said, is to keep painting. And otherwise, we're abdicating our responsibility, I think, as just thinking Christians when we feel like, well, it's all been done and our job is just to proof text the answers. We deal with things today that some things are in principle similar to what people thought about in antiquity, the meaning of life, death, things like that. But there are many things that we think about that the biblical authors could not possibly have spoken into.
Right.
So what do?
Yeah.
Look for a verse and cram it into, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah. it seems like this universe can't be about that.
Yeah.
Right.
It just can't. And if it is, then I'm out. I'm done. But thankfully I'm not inventing a new way. I'm just thinking about how others have done this and I'm trying mm-hmm. to follow in their wake.
We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's get back to the show. Well, one of the things, Pete, you just referenced that biblical authors couldn't possibly speak into, but because of our consistently and ever-evolving milieu, we have new issues, right? And one of the issues in the history of the Christian tradition that you touch on a little bit is that, well, and we've just woken up to this maybe in the last 80 years, is the history of anti-Semitism mm-hmm. within the Christian tradition. I wonder if you can help us with this. I mean, we have a devastating history, right, of being anti-Jewish. And so, Pete, help us out. We don't want to be anti-Jewish. We can mm-hmm. say that. And we want to somehow claim Jesus as unique right. in a way that doesn't eclipse or elide how Jewish he is. So how do we talk about Jesus as Christians? Mm-hmm. And how do we talk about our continuity with our Jewish brothers and sisters that is dissimilar from the anti-Semitic right. missteps we've made in the past?
And of course, it's easy to sort of fall into that wall building thing because mm-hmm. of things the New Testament says. And that's part of the legacy that we have to deal with. And even though, you know, I think to say that Paul is anti-Semitic, I think is frankly nonsense, but he does say things that sound super secessionist. Mm-hmm. And then you have John's gospel, of course, which is notorious for, again, painting a picture that could be taken as anti-Jewish comments. I don't think they are in that context, but that doesn't matter. It's how people have understood them. That's really the issue. And to go back and patiently read through John with people to say, well, it's not against Judaism as a thing. It's against maybe some difficulties that Christian groups were having with Jewish groups and synagogues and things like that. But the fact is that how people have understood it, and we've had to own up to the damage that at least some iterations of Christianity have done in being complicit in anti-Semitism, among many, many, many other things. And to me, it's really more of a warning about, you know, we can't help but being people of our own culture and our own moment. But we also have responsibility to sort of critique the moment as well. I mean, to realize that we're phrasing things in ways that make sense to us culturally, but where do you draw the line in terms of cultural accommodation? And that's an ever-present question. And I think this is one of those issues where that line has been crossed many times. And I think for, I mean, the way my Jewish friends have explained it to me over the years is that, because Christianity is very much about ideas, the right ideas, and having the answers, and Jesus is the answer. And if you don't accept Jesus, you're outside of the answer, you're outside of truth. And, you know, the Jewish tradition has theology, it's got truth, but it looks at things differently. You know, it doesn't have that kind of, that litmus test, which is one person and how you, relate to that one person. That's Jesus, by the way, we're talking about, you know, and I think, you know, it's almost inherent in the system to draw lines, which New Testament authors are drawing, albeit in a first century apocalyptic context, they're drawing those lines, right? They're not drawing them in 21st century, you know, the Western world. So, and that's where theology comes in. See, that's why we can say, yeah, we know the Bible says this, but because of the time, how do we translate this into our own existence? And sometimes that might mean coming up with answers that biblical writers would not have given. And I mean, just, can I give a very quick example of this? It has, you know, with Paul and women, you know, depending on, you know, what text you read, Paul doesn't want women to do stuff, right? And one can understand that the, I mean, Paul's motivation, I think, in certain places might not be against women, but it's the culture that he's living in, right? This is the old argument, which I think holds water. It's the culture that he's living in that would lead him to say, listen, if we upset the social system too much, people are never going to listen to this gospel message. So let's be careful, right? Well, today, I mean, the social setting is entirely different. It's flipped on its head. So how are we better following Paul? By following his exact teaching, so to speak. I'm not big on the idea of biblical teaching anyway, but, you know, to follow what Paul says. Right. Or are we following Paul best by employing the same mindset that Paul had, which is think about how this looks, think about the optics. Mm. And so as a result, we might come to a position on, you know, again, I hate the phrase, the role of women in the church, as a scare quotes, everybody. what, you know, the role of women in the church, we might be following Paul best by doing the opposite of what he said to do.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a clever way of getting out of the Bible. It's not. It's it's engaging it and trying to understand right. How do we live? Because that's the bottom line. It's how do we – it's not just what do we believe to escape hell. It's how are we going to live today and how does that embody what we believe is the presence of God in everything around us? And how what does that look like?
Yeah, that move you're talking about, Pete, isn't that the move Paul himself makes – as well. Mm-hmm. Right. So some of his quote mission, the Jewish missionary enemies that he fights against, right? Galatians, Romans, they want people to be circumcised. Right. He's like, that's if you get circumcised, Jesus is worth nothing to you. And then he circumcises him.
right after the Jerusalem council, when they decide you don't have to do that. He gets some. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And the council gives him – the letter gives him like four things to do, and he at least breaks three of them. So we see Paul doing what you're describing. So we're taking his model versus dropping his words on a different context and just doing those words.
Yeah, and that's the model that – you know, in one of my books, I think it's how the Bible actually works, but it's the wisdom model that it's like – well, what do we do right here? Well, there's no verse that's going to tell you what to do. You got to figure it out. Yeah. What if I'm wrong? Yeah. What if you're wrong? I mean, we're wrong most of the time anyway. So just we're sort of winging it in the spirit here. So let's try to decide what the best thing to do is in this situation. Let's take some risks. Let's have some courage and do what we think is right. And I think the litmus test is how other people are respected as a result of our actions.
Yeah. And let's hold, you know, whatever conclusion provisionally we come to, let's hold it loosely and let's listen to others and let's, you know, be willing to change and repent and learn as we go.
Yeah.
This is kind of related to this way of reading the Bible. But I wonder if we can talk about the gospel a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, for those of us who maybe grew up in evangelical environments, learning Romans Road or the four spiritual laws or something like that. Often I remember being very drawn towards the gospel of the kingdom. So I read, you know, Dallas Willard and, that kind of thing was very compelling to me because it was more than just a plan of salvation or how to get into heaven. Which, you know, for all those reasons, like you're saying, like all those reasons, it was very compelling to me. I was like, oh, this is how you live. Like this is something for now, for the present. So, and a lot of that teaching kind of comes from the gospels, sort of what Jesus taught and Jesus proclaimed, the gospel of the kingdom, the good news of the kingdom. But then, you know, as the church progresses, you've got Paul theologizing and the church reflecting on the death and resurrection of Jesus over hundreds of years to try to figure out what does this mean that Jesus Christ has been raised from the dead, you know, and the Trinity comes out of that and all of that kind of thing. So you've got Paul preaching about Christ crucified, and you got Jesus, you know, preaching about the gospel of the kingdom. And so I don't know. I think that sometimes people are a little, they get confused a little bit. I sometimes get a little confused about this, but how do you integrate these things? Like, how do you make sense of proclaiming good news? If we think about all that together.
Well, yeah. And it's something you said, Ben, is, I mean, it just sparks something that, I think I read it, David Bentley Hart said something like, the New Testament is a Jewish apocalyptic text. And it talked about certain ways, certain things, like the kingdom, you know. But when that didn't happen the way people thought it was going to happen, you start focusing on other things. And, you know, you get Gentile philosophers involved, you know, nothing against them, but then you have creeds that are after something to sort of fine tune who is Jesus anyway. I mean, a great thing to think about, right? But you start wondering, you know, what is this about? Mm-hmm. You know, and is it about, you know, Rome converting to Christianity? Is it about setting up a system? John Caputo, I've mentioned this in other contexts, but he has this book, What Would Jesus Deconstruct? And he says something in that book that actually changed a lot of what I think about this very question, which is Jesus's purpose was not to create the church. It was to foster the kingdom of God. That was plan A. So what happened was things don't end as quickly as people think they're going to end. And so you start bringing in institutional thinking for the long haul, because it's not happening anytime soon. And what happens is that the church then becomes plan B, but we've made it into plan A. And then the question is, well, what's the good news? Well, I don't know, come to church every Sunday and we'll tell you what it is, right? And I think it's a hard question, Ben. I really do. I mean, people, if you ask me, what do you think the good news is? And I was like, I have to think about that for a minute because I'm confused, really. And I mean, that's a horrible thing to say for a college professor, but I'm confused about a lot of stuff, you know? And like, what is good news about it? And I'd like to think that it is, you know, to be connected with your Creator genuinely brings peace. I think it brings peace. It brings love. It brings compassion, and it brings mercy. And to me, the good news is that this is very accessible to us. This is not something that we just have to be willing to look deep inside of us, you know, and you know, maybe putting the ego to the side as much as we can, and thinking about how to live in God's world. Right. And of course, you know, the question then comes up, and it's a good one, is like, well, all religions can do that. You don't even have to be really a theist in a strict sense of the word to think about that sort of thing. And my response is, well, yeah, maybe you're right.
Right.
But then you think, okay, what's the distinctive nature about the Christian faith to bring that along? And that's the part where I have to say, I'm really trying to think of how I want to articulate it. And right now, the closest that I can come to is the model of divine vulnerability that we see in the cross. Mm. And that's sort of weird, actually. You know, yeah. William Plaker, I think is pronounced his name, he died a few years ago, who's a Presbyterian theologian who wrote a book, Narratives of a Vulnerable God. And I think about that book a lot because he says that is God's core characteristic. And that's part of the Jewish Christian message of its scriptures. And think of that as good news for people. You know, think of that.
Yeah.
So maybe the question of what is good news shifts culturally depending on what's going on, right?
Yeah, I love all that. I love your willingness too to just sort of punt with us, you know, and and speak provisionally about such things as the gospel.
That's theology.
I know. It's really great. But
I'll just mention this. When you said being connected to your Creator brings peace, my body said yes. Mm. Like I felt my vagus nerve say hallelujah when you said that. There's something to that. Well, Pete, you cover a lot of ground in this book, Curveball, and you spend a couple chapters talking about quantum physics.
Yeah.
And I love it. Because many of us, I'm not a scientist at all, and I can't understand the math of quantum theory. When I try to read about it and I read about the quantization of energy and the probabilistic behavior of energy quanta, I just start, my eyes glaze over. But there's something about the quantum way of seeing the world of reality, the metaphysic of quantum physics that I'm fascinated by. And I wonder if you could just speak a bit about what about quantum science interests you and what relationship does that have to how you conceive of being a Christian?
Well, like you, I have to be very quick to say that I don't understand this stuff at all, you know? And even the nice homey analogies that scientists use to explain it to stuff, the stuff to people like me, I'm not quite getting it, but I have a big picture of it, you know, and simply the notion that, there's a realm of physical reality that operates by different physical laws than the rest of it. And to me, that alone is like, what did you just, they had to invent a new math to explain this stuff. And it is all math. You know, it's the visual analogies are fine, but it's all math that I will never even want to try to comprehend. It's just too much, right? Yeah. So that alone for me is like, you know, words like mystery come to my mind pretty quickly. And I don't mean mystery, forget about it. I just mean, I think we're just beginning to understand physical reality. We've learned a lot in the past 100 years. I think we're just beginning to. And if you believe in God, then it's like, how much bigger should our theology be than how we sort of understand the Creator now in our limited humanity and our very restricted time and place, and you know, our race, our gender, our economic structures, our level of education, all that kind of stuff can also be limiting, you know, in how we understand the universe. So it's, to me, it's more of a reminder that, yeah, we're just lisping, as Calvin said. We get to play with these things and with some sense of joy, hopefully, and just explore the nature of reality. Mm-hmm. And to think of God as, you know, if creation is bigger than we thought it was, then I think our theology has to follow suit. We have to think of God as, I simply cannot articulate this God, which is itself a metaphor. Even the word God is metaphorical of reality, right? And And I have such great comfort in that notion that, you know, that I simply can't get a handle on this. Mm-hmm. And the older I get, the more I'm like, oh, thank God I can't get a handle. I'd be going crazy if I didn't get a handle on it, right? And so we have this faith that incorporates somehow let's just say an infinite multiverse. And then God somehow caring for this planet, you know, and that's just enough to fill my thinking up for multiple lifetimes, I think.
Yeah.
It's like too much for our 3.5-pound brains.
Yeah.
For this God to be so much bigger than we can really comprehend.
Mm-hmm.
And even as you said before, be so vulnerable.
Right.
For Jesus to come. I mean, it's beyond.
Right.
Mm. I'm curious if I can ask you a personal question.
Sure.
So,
I usually charge for this, but go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Listeners,
send me an invoice.
Take
your book, Inspiration and Incarnation, we talked about, you know, released 20 years ago. It led to your eventual departure from your seminary because of the controversy. I'm wondering, looking back now, looking back from where you are now, what advice would you give young Pete? What do you know now that you think would have helped in 2008 for you to have courage and hope and faith?
Well, I think I had a fair amount of that when I was back then, you know, because I just felt that what I was saying was so worth saying, and I think fairly innocent too. I wasn't really stretching things too much. Certainly the Calvinist world can handle what I was said in that book. I mean, historically it's said most of those things anyway. It's just at that point in time where I worked, there was a minority contingent of faculty members and board members that were not as expansive in their thinking as some of us would have liked. So, but I just did it anyway, you know, and I was told by an administrator once, you just need to resign. And I said, I'm not resigning. You're going to have to get rid of me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, I mean, it's not, people have said, you're so brave. I'm like, I don't know if it's brave. I just don't know how else to do this. You know, it's not arrogant because, I mean, I don't think I write arrogantly. It's just, I have ideas. I want to put them forth and they're conversation pieces. So I, you know, wasn't claiming to fathom the depths of God, but, you know, I said things in that book that some people interpreted, and I think they're wrong, but some people interpreted as being contrary to, you know, the theological system of Calvinism and what came after it. But, I mean, there are things that I was saying that people at Princeton were saying in the 19th century. You know, it's just not that new, but I think it hit at the wrong time, you know, with certain personalities, and that's how I would put it. So, the biggest advice, though, I probably would have given to myself is advice others gave me that I wasn't really ready to hear yet. It was just, there's too much happening. But, I mean, toward the end, it was very difficult. You know, things were just collapsing all over the place with, you know, family stuff and work stuff. And a friend of mine asked me, he said, why aren't you an alcoholic? And I said, 'cause my mom was. That's probably why. It never even entered my mind to do anything like that. You know, I think just the advice I would have given myself was, you told me the vagal nerve, you know, just mine was just is in another room. I didn't even have it at that point. But I said, you know, you can't let them get to you unless you let them get to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I would have tried to cultivate more of a posture of peace, contemplation, maybe meditation, but that wasn't part of my vocabulary back then. I would not have known what to do with that. It was more just fighting, you know, and making your case. And I wrote all sorts of stuff to defend myself, and others did too. And that was bound not to work. And in the meantime, I think I suffered from that in ways that, I mean, it would have been difficult anyway, you know, whatever would have happened would have been difficult. But I think I would have liked to have started a training at that point, in that moment of crisis, to be different on the inside, not just on the outside.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Well, I don't want to make light of the pain mm-hmm. and the journey that you have been on. And I want to say I'm really grateful, like personally, for your work. I've got six mm-hmm. kids, and your writing has impacted me. And so I would say it's impacted them because I'm their mama. And that is because of your truth and the way that you wrote and were, I would say you were brave. You are brave. And just really grateful for that. So
I appreciate that. And I feel, I mean, I that means a lot to me, and I hear that occasionally. And you know, I say the same thing to myself. I can't imagine where I'd be if I hadn't left a place that was, in some respects, very comfortable for me. You know, I mean, I grew up there theologically, and I knew people, I had friends, but it wasn't going to happen. And it took being forced out. You know, I wasn't fired. I actually left. I resigned from the institution, but I would have been fired had I stayed there another few more months. So I just say I got resigned. That's sort of what I tell people, you know. You know, I don't know where I'd be, really, if I had not been forced to leave or left or whatever. And I had no idea what was going to be ahead of me. Mm-hmm. I was so happy for a few months. It's like I was released from prison. Mm. I lost weight, you know, which I had to, too much stress eating for 3 years or so. But then it all fell apart too, because I didn't have anything to believe in anymore. You know, when your system of doctrine is given to you and you have to sign something, then you say, well, I don't want those shackles. And then it's like, well, be careful what you wish for, because if you have nothing, no guardrails, and what do you believe? And that, to me though, that's the journey. And I love the metaphor. I know people overuse it, I think, but for me, that was the journey that I had to take. I had to just leave the comfort of the village and just, I have no idea what's down the road, but all I know is that I can't go back and I can't sit still. I have to keep moving. And so you run into influences, you run into real life people or books or just an offhand story. And all of a sudden you start putting pieces together a little bit differently. I'm glad for it. I mean, I say things now that Pete 30 years ago would have said, you're a problem, you know, you're not even a Christian, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, so I'm happy too, Christy, is what I'm trying to say.
I appreciate you sharing that. I think our listeners will appreciate it as well, because a lot of them are on a really similar journey. you know, again, it's overused a little bit, but deconstruction is a decent word for what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you sharing about just some of the pain, like personal pain and existential sort of crisis that it can send us into.
Right.
Because I think one of the most insensitive things that I see written out there and talked about out there from people who are trying to sort of, you know, circle the wagons and mm-hmm. not lose any more people, you know, is to sort of say that these people are deconstructing because they're looking for an excuse to sin, or they're, you know, but it's like, you know, I just think, like, have you ever talked to anybody who's actually going through this process? Like, mm-hmm. it is the most deeply painful thing, and mm-hmm. it causes such crises for people.
Right.
That it's like that's not what people
and that
are
is
to
courageous.
Do.
Exactly. It takes courage to do that because
yes. yeah.
it's all coming apart. Yes. And you know, life used to make so much sense and now yeah. it stopped making sense, you yeah. know. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that'll be meaningful for our listeners. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
And maybe just one more question. We did this series a little while back on the Bible, kind of how to because that's a lot of our listeners are wrestling with that. Like, well, how do I read the Bible now? And how mm-hmm. does it actually work? Which is, of course, the title of one of your books. But, you know, in that book, How the Bible Actually Works, you make the case that reading the Bible for answers is misusing scripture. That if I go to mm-hmm. the Bible looking for answers, I'm actually misusing scripture. So I wonder if you could just give us the brief elevator pitch for why the Bible wasn't written as an answer book, and two, like why it was written, how it was written to lead us into wisdom, and why mm-hmm. that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, why it wasn't written as an answer book is, I mean, you can look at that even historically, just it was mm-hmm. compiled, and you know, the Jewish scribes that compiled the Hebrew Bible compiled a contradictory text. Mm-hmm. And they must have known it because they can read. Right. You know, and they would take like the two versions of the flood story and bring them together, which gives contradictory information, but that's part of the tradition. You know, Genesis 1 and 2, you know, right. they had different creations, all that kind of stuff. Chronicles and Samuel Kings, it's this, you know, on and on. You know, you have diversity within the text. And so we have that. And when you have that, you can't really get a system of doctrine from the page words on the page themselves. That has to be a second level kind of discussion, which I think is valuable to have. Right. But it, you know, theology is a second level discussion. And I think that is, I mean, I'm understating here, but that's valuable. You know, I think asking the questions of how to put the pieces together, not just the pieces of the Bible, but the pieces of my life and the pieces of the context that I'm in, those are deeply theological and philosophical discussions. Even if we would never use the word theology or philosophy, that we're dealing with something beyond hermeneutics, beyond the exegesis of the text. And I think the Bible itself, by its nature, as any anthology of literature will do, it pushes us in the direction of acknowledging that. And by not allowing itself to be, you know, that simple proof texting thing, because the Bible is not terribly clear at places, and you can use a proof text and it doesn't mean anything because that verse can be legitimately handled in multiple ways, you know, mm-hmm. and in context and in the history of interpretation. So proof texts don't work. It is a living system then. It's something that's moving and breathing and changing and morphing because it's real people embodying it.
Yeah.
And see, to me, that's what it means to, quote, read the Bible. It means to then not read it for information that now is going to tell me everything, but to just lap it up, you know, mm-hmm. and to be well-versed in the story. You know, and you know, to know some parts of the Bible maybe better than other parts of the Bible, but it's not just to know the Bible. It opens up the conversations, I think, with each other and with God about who am I and how do I live and who are you and how does all this work? And we don't get answers to those questions, but I think living in those questions, which is another trite phrase, but living in those questions, yeah. I think is is the means of spiritual growth, frankly. Mm. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that gets at your question, Ben, but I hope.
No, I think that's a helpful way. Okay. I think people are intuiting their way into this, but they still struggle. So they pick up their Bible to read, but it feels disorienting to them. And
some people have to not read it for a while.
Exactly. Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And then I get the question, well, I want to start reading again. Where should I go? It doesn't matter. Just listen. Oh gosh. Listen to your heart. Listen to what's going on inside. It's like, you know, I've never read Habakkuk. Then read it. That's fine. Yeah. You might want to have a good study Bible with you that can answer some questions without being defensive about it. Yeah. The HarperCollins Study Bible, the Jewish Publication Study Bible, things like that. And start looking at it with more of a mindset of curiosity than of worrying and fretting over, I have to read this and then God will like me again, or something like that. It's more like, what do you want to do? And for some people that means literally just, I haven't looked at a Bible in years because I've been so traumatized by it or by how people used it against me.
Yeah.
Yes.
I understand that too.
It's really good. Thank you.
Pete, it's been good to be with you today. What are you working on now? What do you spend your time researching, studying, writing about?
Researching. That's such a lofty word. I teach right now. So it's the middle of the semester. I have been revisiting books that, Christy, when I was going through that stuff at Westminster or whatever, and I came out of it, I started reading some books by whether Thomas Merton or Martin Laird or Thomas Keating or people like that. And I'm at a point in my life right now where I need to revisit those. I just feel like they're old friends. I need to remember why they affected me. So that's sort of what I'm doing now. And I'm trying to do more like pleasure reading too, just fun stuff. That's what my soul needs at this particular moment. And I do a lot of writing, because I have a Substack, so I write once a week for that. And I'm having a blast putting videos up on TikTok where you can say hello and people come after you on TikTok. It's just the most amazing thing. They hate your guts. But the thing is that I have to think about what I'm going to say and then bring it down to 3 to 5 minutes and then try to say it in a compelling way. And that's exercising a part of my brain as well, the teaching part of my brain, but more of in a public setting. So that's sort of what I'm doing with my life nowadays.
Incredible.
Do you choreograph dances to go along with what you're saying on TikTok?
Not yet.
Okay.
Maybe they wouldn't put hateful things.
That's right.
Things
if you just dance.
No, they still would. It's the nature of the medium.
It's true.
I
think that's true. All right. Well, we'll put that TikTok handle in the show notes in case you do ever decide to dance, Pete. I'm sure people would want to see that.
You'll be the first to know.
Pete, thanks so much for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You know, Ben, you referenced this, and I want to just pin it to the top of this closing reflection, and that is a lot of what Pete went through in 2008 leaving Westminster. And, all kinds of horrible things were said about him. None of them were true. He wanted to stay and fight. Eventually, he resigned. So many of you listeners have gone through that with your church or your place of belonging or even your family in the last decade, even 5 years, even 5 months. And so not all of us probably have Pete's confidence. And I think that that's something I want to name. I think it helps. Pete has I don't think he's arrogant, but I think he has a confidence that like, I know my stuff. I know my church history. I know my exegesis. I know what I'm saying here is on the map. And I know that your problems with this has more to do with you than me. Yeah. And I just want to say that that's not everybody listening who's experienced what Pete experienced has that. Mm-hmm. A lot of us feel like people are smarter than me. I was just talking to a friend who recently their church closed. She left her church. She had a lot of problems with the pastor. And the pastor recently wrote a book And she messaged me and she's like, I'm feeling really torn because I've always disagreed with this pastor. I've had some really negative experiences, but they're an expert and they just wrote a book and maybe I should read it to find out how I was wrong. Mm. And yeah, I could tell that she was, I could tell that two things. She just lacked confidence that she could trust her experience that things weren't right. And if she read this book, it would be not cathartic or healing, but it would be, it would be re-triggering for her, you know? And I think that a lot of us come from a similar place where we trust people, you know, we trust the powers that be at a Westminster, and then they come after us for our inspiration and incarnation, whatever that is. And we don't maybe have the confidence that Pete had to be like, no, buddy, you're the problem.
Yeah.
Yep. Man.
It's interesting because I felt like even in him telling his story, it was like a little needle in the tire pump, like pumping my heart a little bit bigger, giving me a little bit more confidence, giving me a little bit more courage because I'm hearing him. Because I think that there are times where we just believe the lie. The narrative that comes in my head all too often is, you really are crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and for somebody else to have a story that's different, but there's similarities that, it is deeply encouraging. And so I hope that that is true, not just for me, but for other listeners who listened.
Yeah. I mean, I recognize those feelings. We just recorded, a little while back, recorded something for our after party podcast, which is for paid members of our community. We talked a little bit about, Matt and I chatted about the history of gravity and kind of where we got started. And, my body got activated talking about that. Just like, man, there's still stuff in here. About going through a traumatic experience. I think sometimes, you know, I don't want to overuse that word because I think it means something very specific, but I could tell like there was something being activated in my body, and I'm maybe not as confident as Pete, but I'm fairly confident. You know, I studied, I trained, like I know my stuff, but even still, when you're inside of that kind of abusive, toxic environment that we had to come out of, there's a longing to just be part of things that is so strong that makes you doubt whether you should be doing this, whether you should be speaking up, whether you should do, you know, it's just like, man, I just want to be part of the group. I just want to be part of the club, you know, like I wish I didn't have to do this. And so anyway, so I remember that. And I want our listeners to feel just so much grace. So much grace. This stuff is so hard to walk through.
Well, Pete even said that, the line of like leaving the comfort of the village.
Yeah.
Totally.
And it is so painful. It is so painful.
Yeah.
And that's real. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, listener, if you haven't checked out our Gravity community yet, that's what we're trying to create. It was great questions on there. Just this week, I threw out a question about how it's hard for me to pray, know how to pray. Wanting miracles, not seeing them. Somebody else is throwing out questions about worship music to listen to. Yeah. And so it's like, it's really like the best of what social media could be without crazy conspiracy theories and images that will get you censored, you know? So join us over there. We're trying to gather that.
Gravitycommons.com/community.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben.
If you'd like to join us. Thanks.
Christy. So, a horse walks in the bar and the bartender's like, why the long face? And the horse is like, my wife just died. Sorry. I have not really been sleeping well. I just realized that's a joke and I missed it. I think I get it now. It's funny because my wife is dead and I'm also a horse. Did I get that correctly? And the bartender's like, hey, I'm sorry. I just thought it was a silly bit. And the horse was like, yeah, because that's what horses love, bits. And the bartender was like, I am so sorry. Can I make it up to you and buy you a drink? And the horse is like, yeah, I'll take the strongest thing you got. And the bartender was like, well, the strongest thing we got and here is me, but I'll give you the next best thing. So he pours him some whiskey and slides it over, and their hands kind of touch, and but they linger. The horse goes to drink the glass, but he kind of struggles because he has hooves for hands. So the bartender goes around the bar and takes it and puts it up to his mouth, and he whispers in his ear, he says, "You know, you don't have to do this alone anymore." And the horse is like, "I want to, but I can't. It's too soon." And the bartender's like, "Hey, you just let me know when you're ready and I'm there." And the horse locks eyes with him and says, "You had me at hay."
That was creepy, dude. I just wanted you to stop. It wasn't even a joke. It was just like, an uncomfortable story.
Like, I don't know.
It was like three jokes, but we were just off to the side in the ditch watching three jokes get combined in a way that didn't make any sense.
Listeners, I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Look, I have to credit, there's a comedian named Madison Sinclair who tells jokes on Instagram to her chihuahua. So she's telling the joke and the chihuahua is like eyes glazed over, and then it keeps going back to her face, and then 5 seconds later it goes back to the chihuahua and the chihuahua's like falling asleep. Anyway, she does some brilliant jokes like this, and you may or may not hear more of them.
Oh boy.
Okay. All right.
Okay. New year, new jokes.
So I don't consider you the chihuahua in this joke.
Am I the chihuahua?
I am short.
I do consider Edie the chihuahua. So
yeah, she's about that size.
That's Ben's dog. Anyway.
Listener, that's my dog. Yes. She's 8 pounds. She's tiny. She's the smallest dog usually in any environment she's in.
Christy, you had me at hay.
Had me at hay.
Wow. Well, there you have it, folks. Thanks for joining us.
Christy's like, why do I do this podcast? No.
No. He has hooves for hands. He needs help with the whiskey.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Listener, hope you enjoyed this episode. I certainly did. Pete was a lot of fun to talk with. And, you know, Matt's okay too. So.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. We'll see you guys next time. Peace. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.